Welcome to the Social Work Discoveries podcast, a podcast about social work, research, and making the world a better place. I'm your host, Ben Joseph, and I'm so glad you've made it here.
And I think what I learned really quickly is, first of all, that this was a client group that needed compassion and attention and commitment to kind of co-designing with them what their support needs were, because nobody had any clue how to do it.
If you're interested in how research is a useful approach to making a difference, or if you're thinking that you'd like to use research in your own community or organisation, or if you're simply keen to hear stories of change, then you've come to the right place.
The systems, everything was interconnected at that very young age, that care and the way that we treat our children in child protection was very much connected with the adult criminal justice system.
But really, social work is about being human and how we are human together. And I think that that's relevant to every single person.
Welcome again to the Social Work Discoveries podcast.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Social Work Discoveries podcast. I'm your host, Ben Joseph. And I'm so happy to have you with me today. The rise of the biomedical approach to treatment of depression and anxiety, among other mental health issues for Australians, has been swift, expansive, and for many, completely all-consuming. It is the dominant lens through which we as a society believe mental illness can be administered and recovery can be found. But is it the only answer? In today's Social Work Discoveries episode, I speak with a man on a mission to expand the conversation by asking questions about the status quo of the biomedical approach in mental health treatment and offering perspectives on additional, if not alternative, approaches towards a life of recovery from mental illness. My guest today is Anthony Smith, author of the recently released book, Default Depression: How We Now Interpret Human Distress as Mental Illness. It's published through Wakefield Press, and the link for the information is in the show notes. Anthony is a former board member of Suicide Prevention Australia, and he's the co-author of papers and reports promoting the situational approach, a concept that offers a fresh way of considering mental health by taking situational factors such as economic and social disadvantage and workplace stress into account when diagnosing and treating depression and anxiety disorders. For more than two decades, Anthony has worked across Australia with networks such as Primary Health, the life insurance industry, men's sheds, and human resources, and at the community level in suicide prevention and research. It's a pleasure to have you join us on the Social Work Discoveries podcast, Anthony.
Yeah, well, thanks, Ben. I really do appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate that you've looked into this enough to see the merit for your listeners. I see it as a great opportunity to talk about this, not just the book, but the background to it and the possibilities ahead. And I'll enjoy later on in this conversation to talk about some concrete programs, projects that are just starting that really do align with the thrust of the Default Depression book.
Great. Well, let's start with a bit of background and begin our conversation finding a little bit more about who you are and why you're interested in focusing so much of your time and to understand mental health prevention and recovery of mental illness. Where did this kind of lifelong journey begin for you?
Well, it's not really a lifelong journey, and it was never a calling or anything, but I used to work in health promotion on the central coast of New South Wales, and in the late 90s, the middle to late 90s, there was a lot of publicity about youth suicide deaths on the central coast. So it became part of the health promotion work. And as a result of that, I, for more than 10 years, worked fairly closely with the coroner's office on the central coast. And early on, it became very clear that the And that's a fairly big group, you know, if you're looking at a representative sample of the country, over 300,000 people. So the data that we collected on suicide deaths was telling us a different story than what we were getting the general publicity and government material and things. So myself and others on the Central Coast tried to publicise and challenge some of the narrative of the time. And through that, I became involved with the Western Sydney University and Professor John McDonald. And so from that, we started doing research, a very unique collaboration between a coroner's office, New South Wales Health, the Health Promotion Unit, and Primary Healthcare University. But what we did was we put aside the idea of depression. The title, in fact, we used the word despair. What brings people, in this case men, to such despair? And already we were seeing that the focus or the emphasis on depression was way overplayed, and that in fact when you talked to the families through the, you know, the ethical clearance of with the coroner's office, families were invited to participate if they liked. It was entirely their decision, and so the research was, you know, interviews with the families and friends of men who had killed themselves. You know, what we saw was, you know, a lot of, you know, using that academic sort of terminology, adverse life events in their lives, including unemployment in particular, and you know, whether that was based on, you know, a lifetime of difficulty from their childhood even. But what we found was that really there was an accumulation of adverse life events. And so that was the start of that particular direction. You know, from that mid-2000s, 06, 07, I was on the board of Suicide Prevention Australia as a New South Wales state delegate. But it became clear to myself and others around that time that the narrative, the messaging, the policy development of all of what we call the mental health sector, including suicide prevention, was dominated by just a few high-profile organisations and individuals. You know, the biomedical approach became the dominant way of seeing all of these things. You know, so for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years, any research into suicide deaths was almost going to have depression in it to be funded and to then be published. You know, community program activity would often have to centre around depression, you know, and those sorts of messages. Oh, you know, maybe he's depressed, he should go and talk to the doctor. So I stepped aside from Suicide Prevention Australia, and then I continued with this. I took a work redundancy at the start of 2010 and was hoping to break into that area. I had some experience and expertise now. And then a really interesting thing happened in the mid-teens of 2016 was, and this is where it all started becoming a whole new illumination of what was going on for me. I was approached by a consultant from the life insurance industry. He'd been asking around, thought that there was something wrong with the way it was going, because the life insurance industry was now under an enormous amount of economic pressure, because so many people from the workplace policy were being directed to general practice to be diagnosed with a mental disorder. And often that was actually conditional on ongoing workplace support. And so in lots of cases, we're talking about a large scale here, the financial support for long-term being away from work was covered by life insurance through superannuation packages. Now, I had no idea about all of that until I started going to these meetings, 2017, 2018, and that led to University of Western Sydney having some involvement in some of those meetings, and then John McDonald, as the Professor of Primary Healthcare, found a small amount of money to pay me to write a monthly e-newsletter. Credit to John, he gave me some free rein on the sorts of topics under the banner of situational approach to suicide prevention. And over 20-odd months, I investigated a number of these sorts of related themes. How much was it costing the life insurance industry? How many people now were being diagnosed with mental disorders, particularly depression and anxiety disorder? And as a consequence of that, how many people were now being prescribed antidepressants? And so by the time it got to COVID times and the lockdowns, I had accumulated quite a deal of information. And in the meantime, John Ashfield, who was a PhD psychotherapist, he and I wrote the first two situational approach papers. And that's where the Western Sydney University decided to do the newsletters around that theme, because the curious thing was, people in the life insurance, senior people that I was meeting, understood the concept of situational approach, where, you know, people in the suicide prevention mental health sector didn't get it even after 15 years of trying to explain it's not just about depression. They got it in 5 minutes. And so that's became the birth of those first couple of papers, because John Ashfield and I had written quite a deal of stuff in the 3 or 4 years leading up to that. And I just said to John once, why don't we just put the best of that stuff together and call it the situational approach, because people understand it. One thing I did want to say about that was that, you know, if you look at the situational approach, I think there'd be a lot of people in the community who would look at it and say, yes, but that's only common sense. And I would agree with them. The trouble is, why we had to write it was because that sector, the mental health suicide prevention sector, is built on the perception of expertise. And one of the ways you can maintain expertise is using medicalized language and medicalized processes. You know, we do research to see whether SSRI type antidepressants work in the brain. So we must be the experts. And thankfully now there does seem to be a real openness to challenging the merit of a lot of that, not just the research, but the general messaging around that sort of thing.
So it sounds to me, Anthony, that there's a bit of, you've noticed a bit of gatekeeping from particular sectors around how it is that suicide prevention and mental health treatment are administered and facilitated, and that the work's actually done out there. I have a question in the back of my mind as I listen to you talk. You know, what's the risk, do you think, of purely coming at this work, suicide prevention strategies, mental health treatment and illness treatment, from that biomedical model, like the depression diagnosis? What are the risks that you have identified, or the areas of maybe gaps or some, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but
yeah,
what's the space here that you think, we need to just step back and think this through at a more holistic level?
Yeah, rethink this through, that's right. I like the way you use the term gatekeepers there, because they have been the gatekeepers. I mean, even federal funding is often channeled down through one organisation, so that the community, at the community level, if they want to get funding, it has to suit the planning, which, you know, is a synonym for business agenda for that one organisation on the national scale. And so, again, that focus on depression at the exclusion of anything else. And I might say that I think there are a lot of people who understand this and will jump on board as we begin to open up the different ways of looking at it. But so the gaps, as you're talking about, yeah, well, first of all, just because somebody is feeling troubled or distressed doesn't mean they have a mental disorder. That's the first important thing. And to push somebody away from their workplace or whatever other circumstance, or from, you know, in schools for children, it's just horrific what's happening, what's going on. And with the school case, you know, the child's, maybe a bit distracted, whatever it is, policies now, well, you know, maybe the child has got anxiety disorder. So, you know, parents are then pressured to take the child to a GP, where they're under those circumstances highly likely to be diagnosed with one of just a few different mental disorders.
So it feels like anxiety.
I just wanted to finish there though. So on top of that, then to be prescribed antidepressants for children on a large scale, and we're only learning now, we're only being able to make it public now, some of the challenges around the consumption of antidepressants, both the side effects of the antidepressants themselves and the challenges to withdrawal.
So it sounds to me as though you're proposing that there's an over pathologization of children and people who are experiencing distress, whether it's in the workplace or for whatever reason, and that's not necessarily the whole picture.
Yes, pathologization, you know, is a good word. And look, a lot of this is done from people with good intention. You know, HR people, I'm sure they want to try and help, but they've been over 2.5 decades, they've been instilled in them the idea of, for example, language. We can talk about language shortly. The workers are trained to identify symptoms of depression. So already we've got a culture of the clinical approach to, you know, trying to help that person there.
I want to move the conversation a little further into talking about this current status quo within this sector, in this space. So you've released a book called Default Depression, and it's a pretty direct critique of the contemporary approaches and discourse to mental health diagnosis and treatment. And it's been garnering a lot of interest of late, the book. But it also seems to coincide with a lot of interest around this topic in the media more generally. Like, what's happening today out there in the sector, in your view, that's led you to write this book and try and promote it to address the current status quo?
I was putting together some of the recent articles that have been published both in reputable journals and in general media, often as a response to the publishing of the articles in the reputable journals, just for the last 1 year. And I was describing it as a tide of change. There is a great new receptiveness to these things. And lo and behold, just the other week, the ABC, Michael Rowland, interviews an associate professor from the United Kingdom about these issues, and Michael Rowland on the ABC described it as a growing push. A couple of days later, the ABC News interviewed John Jureidini about the challenges to withdrawal of antidepressants. So, the British Medical Journal just in December last published a very strong piece from about, a dozen or more people, including senior academics like Professor Joanna McCreef and people from other sectors, all saying, you know, we've got to do something about this, the over-prescribing of antidepressants. And then, as I say, more recently, the issue about withdrawal. So next April, I think it is, there'll actually be a formal, in the United Kingdom, the publishing of a formal guidelines for tapering off antidepressants and other similar drugs. How do we get to that? That we have to have guidelines to taper off the drugs that we were put onto.
What's the risk? What's the risk, Anthony?
There's some horrific things that happen. I'm not an expert on that side, but I would invite any of your listeners to just simply go to iView, ABC iView, and you can see a BBC show that was aired by the ABC just in, I think it was last August, called The Story of Antidepressants. And you'll cop a fair understanding of the sorts of challenges that people have got. And in that, a recent past president of the United Kingdom's Royal College of Psychiatrists apologises to the camera about the fact that they hadn't taken the withdrawal side of antidepressants seriously enough in the past. Coming back to bite them.
What I like about your book and kind of where it's positioned, and I want to get to the concrete examples later in the conversation, but for now, just about the book, what I like about it is that it's a repositioning of the notion of how do we prevent this holistically. And I'm not talking about necessarily never touching medications as an approach, but having this holistic approach and revisiting that in earnest. Is that what you're trying to do with this book, or is it something else?
Yeah, it is partly that, for sure. I've been going on about this sort of thing for some time. Like I say, back in 2006, I presented to the Suicide Prevention National Conference as a member of the board of Suicide Prevention Australia, based on the very clear evidence from the Coroner's Office on the Central Coast that we need to look at issues about make unemployment a priority and de-emphasise depression. That requires that we have upstream policies about things like unemployment. So, some greater accountability when it comes to, you know, what they call restructuring and the offering of, you know, packages for workers that if they don't get work, they soon run out of the package and then they're in trouble. And I've worked with lots of long-term unemployed men that becomes a real challenge. So, yeah, so it's the upstream prevention that I'd like to see. And that, you know, means a good deal of thinking about how to integrate services so that their policies, you know, are aligned so that they can support people in the community in a better way. Like I say, the model for the shed where in New South Wales, there in Western Sydney, where the people from the different agencies, it was part of their job description to walk with the people who are in trouble, whether it was financial trouble or legal trouble or trying to get a job or housing trouble. So it wasn't just a, you know, tick the box and then send them off to Centrelink or something. They walked with the people to try and resolve those challenges.
That's a good segue into what I want to focus on next. And you've talked about it quite a bit, but let's be really direct and specific about it. This notion of the situational approach, it's a lens through which we might rethink, reconceptualize the complex issues relating to poor mental health, to distress, to grief, to suicide prevention, but also experiences of recovery. When you talk about the situational approach, what are you talking about?
Well, like I said earlier, you know, I think a lot of people, when they read what I've written in this book and their other papers, they're going to get it straight away because it's common sense. You know, there are circumstances people find themselves in that that are troubling, that are distressing, that cause them stress. And they might be job insecurity or no job or difficult workplace conditions. It may be financial troubles other than work. It might be legal troubles. You know, it might be relationship troubles. And these cause stress, and it's only human to feel troubled in those circumstances. And so really that's what the situational approach boils down to. And like I say, that sounds like common sense, and it is. But the expertise, as you know, of the mental health sector has so corralled the way we talk about and research and plan our program activity in terms of mental health and suicide prevention, it takes away from the opportunity to approach this with a sensible, community-minded way of going about it.
This will be really interesting.
And language, I would like to talk about, because that's, as I said earlier, that's a key part of it. And one of the things that I'm really pleased with and getting a lot of really good feedback about the book is that I've dedicated a fair bit of the book to language, both in terms of critique of the sort of current language that is used in that mental health suicide prevention sector, but also some options. And that, you know, John Ashfield and I started doing that with the initial situational approach papers, you know, situational distress rather than clinical depression. Simple as that.
This will be really interesting for our listenership as predominantly social workers who are interested in how it is that research might improve their practice, explain their practice, you know, expand their practice. and also help, you know, community development and create some social change. And I think the reason why this will be interesting is just the notion of stepping back and thinking about social determinants of health and creating change in a system that a person might live within that helps them to thrive rather than feel pressure or distress or grief or even depressed and low mood. You know, social workers have a lot of skills in that systemic work that they do, in creating social change for people. And so I think there's going to be a really strong resonance for them with this book. I guess just thinking about social workers and the idea of walking alongside and working with.
Yes, you know, nice.
How might they engage with the situational approach and the things that you talk about in this book on a practical level?
Look, like I said a little bit earlier, and I'm fully with you in terms of social and structural determinants and the upstream side of prevention. And as you say, that's all about being involved in agencies and government and policy development. And so people with the skills that you're talking about there, this actually presents them with an enormous opportunity to start bringing things together in a better way than it has been. Instead of over here is the mental health suicide prevention sector and over here are all our other sectors. No, you know, that's the way it's presented, but in fact, that's not how it functions. Those organisations, the leadership of that mental health suicide prevention sector have for 2.5 years been infiltrating all other sectors and influencing the policy development. So the workplace, for example, with their workplace mental health policy has largely been a perpetuation of that whole biomedical approach. As I gave that simple example, workers are trained to identify symptoms of depression. And the other thing for social workers, if they're looking into these sorts of things, is I might encourage them to reconsider or review what is presented as evidence from that particular sector. And the really good example that I can present is that in 2006, as I said earlier, I presented on evidence from the coroner's office on the Central Coast about the place of unemployment. And I can say that one of the things I'm excited about at the moment is that just last year, the federal government, through the Medical Research Future Fund, has funded a 2-year project at Adelaide, University of Adelaide, to look at suicide prevention, looking at unemployment, presumably based on evidence. So it's taken, you know, from 2006 to 2023 to finally do something serious about this. But the evidence was there all the time. And so that's why I say I just encourage people to, you know, be sceptical about the presentation of what is said to be the evidence. It might be true in its own right, but might be only a partial account of the complexity of what's going on.
Makes a lot of sense. And I think that the social workers listening to this will probably be nodding along as they listen in their car or while they're doing the washing up or wherever it is they listen to their podcast. And thinking to themselves, yeah, I'm thinking about this person that I'm working with who potentially does have some vulnerabilities around suicide risk and poor mental health. And my work in walking alongside them to address their social needs is something that's that there is like a tether for them. You know, it's something that they're holding on to, and we're addressing those risks holistically, which may include psych appointments and medications and that type of thing, but it's not the only thing that they're thinking about. And I love that there's a book out there that just is adding to that conversation and adding to the weight of the importance that social workers are doing in this space, not just social workers, but the people working on suicide prevention and improving mental health across the community. I'll go on, Anthony.
I totally agree with that, but I'd also add to it. You see, one of the terms we explore in our language thing is the term mental health itself, because it is so ambiguous the way it's used. And I would say, let's not even use the term poor mental health. You know, let's accept that somebody's struggling and we find out that there's these things going on. Well, they're struggling. They don't have poor mental health. So, you know, I'm not having a go at you, Ben. I'm just saying that's how enculturated this whole thing is. I mean, I'm only now myself on starting to get on top of these sort of things. I would have accepted that term a year ago, even while I was writing the book. But now I'm attuned to when it's used. And so, like I say, the book gives people an opportunity to start reflecting on, maybe I could use that one. And we do know that we've already got general practice. We've got doctors written endorsement and have already been using the situational approach definitions for some time now in their practice, and they find that helps. So the scenario is somebody comes in and says, you know, whether they've been pushed there from their workplace or their friends or whoever, I think I've got depression. And a doctor can say, well, maybe it's not depression. Talk about what's going on and, you know, maybe let's see if we can find you some psych help or some financial help or what have you.
That's a really good example, both the GP and talking about even my use of language there. And it's really clear how enculturated it becomes when you are just talking about the discourse in general. Really good example. Let's keep talking about examples, though.
Yep.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation there were some concrete things, projects and ways of working. Let's touch on that. What do you mean when you talk about that?
Yeah, so like I said, the federal government last year funded a project with University of Adelaide, and I'm pleased to say that I will have a role in that. Now, it's not a small project. It's a two-year, $900,000 research project, and it's broken up into these four work projects that they're called, and the health equity led by Professor Fran Boehm will be looking at the bigger picture side of things, trying to learn about what's been going on around these issues of unemployment, financial difficulty, et cetera, with the objective of ultimately developing policy recommendations for government levels, for employers. It's a very impressive scope that they've got. Now, one of the work projects will be at the Centre for Ethical Mental Health, led by Professor John Girardini and Melissa Raven, who I know well, and I'll be working with them. And their project will be, for the first year, looking at developing training for GPs on this very issue of what sort of language can a GP use? How can a GP engage with somebody who might be unemployed? And that'll be a whole year. And then the second year of that same group will be similarly, but looking at working with staff at Centrelink and welfare agencies, etc., to the same end. You know, how can I better work and engage with somebody rather than, you know, maybe they've got a mental disorder, maybe they should go and talk to the GP about their depression. You know, that's a big step forward. Like I say, it's been a long time coming, but the leaders like John Girardini and Melissa Raven have been involved in some very strong recent work in those sorts of general media publicity that we were talking about earlier. So it is rather like we're riding the crest of a wave. We've got to hang onto the boards, and you know it's a long way to the shore yet, but it's a good start.
Okay, I love that metaphor, you know, riding the wave, and it's still a long way to the shore, but it suggests that there is a landing place at some point. As we begin to close this conversation, I'd love to know, you know, what's the landing point? What are we shooting for here, Anthony? What's the hope?
You know, there's the little bit that I can do, and then there's the bigger thing that lots of other people can do, and that's why I say I think that there's more than enough competent people out in the community, passionate people who are already working in these sorts of areas, and I know from conversations, but who have felt stifled and constrained in what they would like to do. And so, you know, they can help people very well once they've already tipped over the edge. But as far as being able to be helpful in working towards that upstream stuff that we're talking about, you know, that social workers might step into. So once we can start cutting the ties to that strong influence that those few organisations and people have got on the whole, what we call mental health, then I think we can start seeing better opportunities, better integration, better planning, more useful research. So that's the bigger picture. My part is I'm going to enjoy seeing if we can start changing the language that's being used in the different sectors. If, you know, hopefully we might be able to do some work in with HR sector. That's a possibility. We're waiting to see whether we can get some support for that. But certainly the work at University of Adelaide is funded and has already started. So I'm looking forward to having my role in that.
Anything you'd like to leave with us as we end our conversation today, Anthony? Any final words for our listeners?
Go out, honestly, go out and buy the book, because, you know, just the other day, a person down in my street who I've known for, you know, some years, we say good day, you know, and she said, wow, because that's what I think. People haven't had the chance to see this broader picture of it. What they've been given is the same sorts of messages. You know, funding goes into the same sorts of programs. Community things have the same sorts of things for the last two decades. You know, have another footballer come along and talk about their depression. I'm not saying that shouldn't happen. I'm just saying that we've had a very limited range of activities that we call mental health prevention.
Anthony, it's been a pleasure having you on the Social Work Discoveries podcast today. If you're listening and you want to find out more about Anthony's work and his book, Default Depression, published through Wakefield Press, then please check the details in our show notes, or otherwise, give it a Google. And until next episode, all the best. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Ben. Fantastic.
Be sure to keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes coming your way soon of the Social Work Discoveries podcast. This podcast is hosted and produced by Dr. Ben Joseph from Western Sydney University in partnership with Social Work Media, with Dr. Mim Fox from the University of Wollongong, Liz Murphy, and Justin Stesch. The music for this podcast was created and produced by Ben Grace. You can find all of Ben's music on Spotify or at bengracemusic.com. Don't forget, you can follow Social Work Discoveries on Twitter by using the handle @SWDiscoveries. Make sure you reach out and say hi. And please remember, you can always access the back catalogue of episodes at swdiscoveries.com. This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Cabrigal clan of the Darug Nation, lands that were never ceded. All of us at Social Work Discoveries and Social Work Media acknowledge and pay respects to the elders, both past and present, of these lands, waterways, and skies.